All rise. Illinois Appellate Court, 5th Division is now in session. Honorable Justice Sharon O. Johnson is presiding.
Don't Mitchell.
I apologize.
It's no problem. Okay, please be seated.
Good morning, folks. If our clerk could call our case.
123-0555, In Re Estate of John Marcy.
Okay. Morning, folks. So, we have, as you know, we've read the briefs. We're familiar with the authorities cited in therein and, of course, with the record. So you can take that into account. With your comments this morning. We're going to allot 20 minutes aside with an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant, so you don't need to reserve time. If, when you step up, if you could be kind enough to identify yourself and also keep your voice up because the microphone records but does not amplify. And with that, we'll get started. Counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, I'm Patrick Solon, and my client is John Podmajerski III, and following what we did in the briefs, because these are all family members, we'll use the informality of first names, not disrespecting anyone. May it please the court. I'll start with the count one, the July 2014 will that was the jury case, where the trial court entered a directed verdict in 2024 after originally denying the directed verdict in his 2023 rule. And as a directed verdict...
Was that sua sponte, or was there a motion to reconsider?
There was a motion pending, but it wasn't a motion to reconsider. And the trial court at a hearing... actually on a privilege issue, on our privilege motion, he said that he wanted to revisit and was having second thoughts about directed verdict. He did ask for some more briefs. There's some more briefing that comes after the trial court says that, and his ruling is a few months later. It was his idea. That's a question of law. So, as you know, we get the inferences and all that. There's no deference due to any facts as viewed by the trial court. And here, where Lisa, in 2014, she's a multiple fiduciary. And in our brief, we argue how the special rule for fiduciary undue influence applies here. And in the context of directed verdict, the law in Illinois is that you cannot have a directed verdict if the plaintiff has a prima facie case using those four factors in the DeHart precedent. And the four factors involve a fiduciary who benefits from a new will and who participates in the preparation. And if you have evidence of that from which a jury could render a verdict, you're entitled to an inference of undue influence without any extra proof. You don't need direct influence proof. The Nemeth case cited makes clear that if you've got the prima facie case with the four factors, you can't have a judgment as a matter of law. And that Nemeth's not a directed verdict. It actually affirmed a court decision. But a verdict is a directed verdict, a judgment is a matter of law. And if we have evidence of the four factors, the case goes to the jury. That's how it was laid out in the discussion of the presumption and the IPI pattern jury instructions during the trial. It's a different framework during the trial. Will the plaintiff get an instruction about a presumption where the jury must find undue influence?
Well, so this ultimately boils down to whether there's evidence that the will was, the preparation of the will was procured by the beneficiary, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. That's the four elements, that's the only one they dispute. She's clearly a fiduciary. She's in the will. And I'll turn to that right now on the procurement element. So under the law, procurement is the person that is instrumental or participated in the preparation, or they prepared it themselves. She didn't write the will, so it's preparation, participating in the preparation. And we have ample evidence that would support a finding of that that's in the record. Now, first, you know, they concede that Lisa is the conduit between these attorneys, including the estate planning attorneys, and her father. And the argument and the assertions at trial was, well, it's only ministerial. She has no substantive involvement. But there's no question that she's the go-between. And she is discussing estate planning with the estate planning arm of the Perkins Coie firm. And also, during the course of that representation, first with this, with Attorney Domingo Suk, first at McDermott
Law. What's the evidence that she's discussing estate planning? There's some evidence that she's discussing Ann's estate planning because of that Churchyard's lawsuit and the settlement negotiations. But what's the evidence that she's communicating estate planning issues with regard to John?
Well, we have the disputed May 10, 2014 email,
right,
that had the privilege claim, and that's dead on. That's she's
so and I know we're jumping around issues now, but one of the things that I've been trying to understand is you folks dispute whether the trial court conducted an in-camera of a redacted or unredacted email, and having done many in-camera inspections, I don't know why a judge would ever need to do one for redacted documents. The whole purpose of a in-camera is to determine whether the information that's been redacted is properly subject to privilege. So,
sure.
I mean, it would seem to me that the judge would have had to have reviewed unredacted documents.
Well, let me try to clear that up. So in the document that's in the record, at there's an email chain. It's in the supplemental exhibit, SUP E 3620, in volume 4, and it runs through 3623. And there's multiple emails. Our argument is about the second email. It's from Domingo Suk. It's May 10 at 12:30 p.m. It's to Lisa and to Eric Brand from Brenner, the litigation attorney. And he adds to the subject matter some estate plan specifics. All right, now, regarding redacted, unredacted, what the trial court looked at has redactions in it, but it's not all redacted. And our argument is that the text in Mr. Suk's email that we all can see, it's here, it's right here, that shows that it's about estate planning. Lisa writes to her litigation attorney about settlements. That's the first one. Mr. Suk, he's in the loop. You see it on the log. He's in the loop on all this litigation stuff. He jumps in. He jumps in. He says, hey, wait, let me summarize specifics so we are clear on the estate plan. And then he goes into detail explaining to Lisa about the state of the estate plan.
Ann's estate.
No, it's about trusts, a marital and a family trust, on which John the father has, your father can exercise his power of appointment over the marital and family trust and leave nothing to JP3, John. So he's saying, hey, Lisa, your father can do this. He has the power to do this. The mother's dead at the time. In default of him exercising this power, then the division is 25% to JP3, 75% to you. And, of course, it closes after some redaction. Now is the time to have your father update his estate plan. So they argue this is about the mother's estate plan, but the mother is gone, and it clearly is saying, your father needs to do something. If he doesn't do it, your brother's going to get money. But if he does do it, you'll get more money and your brother gets less. I mean, this is Mr. Sue telling Lisa, not telling John this, he's telling Lisa this. We need to do something. So that, it's not privilege because the testamentary exception. When Mr. Soup jumps into a litigation chain and starts talking estate planning, that part's not privilege.
I'm still not clear on, are you saying that the document that the judge reviewed, the May 10th email that the judge reviewed, is the document that you have in front of you, which is the redacted document? And
correct.
My question to you would be, why would a judge ever want to review a redacted document?
Because the parties were fighting about the unredacted portion. They claimed that this, the part we can see.
So you're saying that the redacted portion, there is no dispute about that?
Well, that's it. We can't just, we don't know how to dispute it. We can't, we've never seen it.
We asked for an in-camera inspection.
Well,
that's typically how it works.
Yeah.
That's why I'm puzzled by the same point that then it's really not an in-camera inspection. The judge isn't reviewing anything that the parties, that each side hasn't already seen.
Well, on this, sort of agreed, Your Honor. I mean, as to this document, he ruled. They had produced it, and they said, we didn't mean to produce it. We claimed privilege on the unredacted part. Our side was arguing, this is not privilege, and you need to do an in-camera inspection. And that's what he found. So R53 in the record is, he finds that what he can see is privileged. And it's clawed back. So they get it back, and the privilege claim is upheld. We say that's abuse of discretion. It's wrong as to what we can see from Mr. Suk. In addition, there was a broader motion, which he denied, saying, I find no rational basis to do it. He wouldn't look at the law or the redaction.
But what you read from that email is the attorney, Suk, informing the parties to the email what the trust document provides for in terms of division of assets, correct?
It does do that.
Okay, and it says, and what else does it say?
It says that your father can change it.
Can change it,
okay. And that he needs to update his estate plan to change it. And by change it, he means to further disinherit Johnny.
Well, that's an inference you're drawing from that, right?
Well, no, it says it. The time is coming to have your father update his estate plan, given the death of your mother.
Okay.
And early on, he says what the plan is to do is to exercise the powers of appointment, disinherit Johnny. And it's that email. They talk about the other, you know, the first email from Lisa to Mr. Brand from Brenner. You know, that's not what we're arguing.
So we sidetracked about the email. If you could get back to the question that we started with, which is the evidence that you have to show that Lisa procured this change in will.
Yes. And so Lisa, you know, for years she's working closely with these attorneys. She's the point of contact with the attorneys, estate planning attorneys and litigation attorneys. And if we just look at 2014, there's no evidence that John was asking to do anything with his estate plan. We see, you know, Mr. Sue talking to Lisa about it. And there is
evidence that there's a conflict, right, between John and Johnny at the time?
A conflict?
Conflict.
No, we don't agree with that at all.
So you're saying there's no evidence of a conflict?
Well, I won't say there's no evidence of it, but it's hotly disputed. Until 2012, when Lisa brings in her attorneys of choice, and then there's, you know, litigation that the parents, the record doesn't reflect the parents really understanding anything about the litigation.
Is there evidence that they didn't understand what was going on with the litigation?
Yes. It was July 2012, the lawsuit gets filed, and then Johnny, who's hit with this out of the blue, no history, decades of working close with the parents, he's being sued. by his parents, and there was no, you know, no rumblings. It just bang from these new attorneys, and then he filed the guardianship. There were guardians ad litem, and so the mother's guardian ad litem talked to her, and in that record, she didn't realize that a lawsuit had been filed.
Leading up to the lawsuit being filed, there was a lot of communication back and forth between John's attorney and Johnny's attorney about getting financial records, getting disbursements to pay medical bills, care for Ann.
And that's Mr. Cloud at McDermott Will, and that team, Mr. Suk, working with Lisa. The record doesn't document John running the litigation lawyers and all of this. John, and it's in the briefs how some of that correspondence is saying things that just don't make any sense. They wrote to John's landlord suggesting he was the attorney or something. Our position in the case, supported by the evidence, is that these are the lawyers Lisa brought in, and she's running it, and the mother doesn't even realize there's a lawsuit on file. The father's guardian ad litem doesn't even ask about he didn't ask about the lawsuit, so we don't see a record of John being aware of the lawsuit, right after its filing. And,
the lawsuit was verified or signed by John and Ann, wasn't it?
Their signatures do appear. But that's not conclusive evidence that they understood what was going on.
Well,
someone else was running it. And now
the question really is, whose burden is it? Is it their burden to show that John understood what was going on, or is it that your burden to show that John didn't understand what was going on and he was influenced by Lisa in procuring the change?
Our position is there's conflicting evidence and it permits multiple inferences.
Could I ask a slightly different point? It's the interplay between your first issue that you identify in your opening brief and the second issue. The second issue being that it was improper for the trial judge to enter a judgment on the trust count. While this will count was not decided by the jury.
Right.
For that to work, you have to win on issue one. That is to say, the trial court erred by directing verdict. True?
I agree. We also, on count two, we also have the argument that the privileged email and potentially other improperly privileged, that they're not privileged, that that's material evidence that could affect the outcome. So on count two, we have two arguments. But the constitutional argument is that jury right on count one required the trial judge to wait on count two. And yes, that matters if there's going to be a jury on count one.
Right. Okay.
So if there's a directed verdict on count one, then that argument on count two doesn't apply.
So you pointed to the email. What other evidence do you have that? And you pointed to the fact that Lisa was involved with the lawyers. What other evidence do you have to show the undue influence?
Yeah. So we rely on the entire sequence from 2011 going forward, where there's no history of any dispute between son and parents. And it all takes a significant turn.
But there is a history of dispute. There's a lawsuit.
No, not as of 2011, there's none. July 2012, Your Honor.
When's the church shared lawsuit?
July 2012.
Right. So you're saying that you said there's no history of any dispute between 2011 and 2014?
No.
I misunderstood you.
Until 2012.
Until 2012.
Okay. Right. And so in 2011, there's what we think is an important episode where 2010, Lisa brings in Mr. Suk. It doesn't stick. They don't go with Mr. Suk. In 2011, John, of his own volition, has nothing to do with Johnny or Lisa, brings in his attorney, Patrick Began. And John hires Mr. Began. There's meetings with him. And as part of that, John tells Mr. Began, his attorney, that he does want to sell the properties to Johnny. And there was the proposal that was pending, and John is not, that's not treason in John's mind. He's willing to go forward with it, and he tells his own attorney that. And Lisa's in the loop on the discussions with Began, and when she finds out that, you know, John wants to go forward with this, she steps in, and she actively interferes with that attorney relationship, and she gets it shut down. She's holding a power of attorney at the time. Mr. Began wrote one for her. And so she says, Mr. Began, send the bill to me. I want the bill. If the bill had gone to the father, it would, his bills were being paid from the company, by Johnny, and Johnny would have seen the bills and would have paid them, would have paid his father's bill. Instead, Lisa gets hold of it, give me the bill, doesn't pay it, lawyer drops out. At the same time, she's communicating again with Mr. Suk. So this is mid-2011, and she's saying things like, my mom and dad insisted they want you, Mr. Suk, to represent them, when that, there's no, that's not true. And they didn't want Mr. Suk. And that Johnny, was the one unduly influencing the parents, pressuring to do the sale, and they're cracking under his pressure. When in reality, John had his own attorney, Mr. Began, representing only him and not beholden to anyone else, and was working with that attorney to consider this sale proposal. So she shuts that down successfully. And, you don't pay the lawyer, he's not going to keep working. And then she gets Mr. Suk back in. It sticks this time. Other than one meeting where Johnny was invited, he's totally out of the loop on that, but Lisa is in the loop. Then the mother goes, the mother gets really sick, is in hospital and then rehab. As she's coming out, Lisa has moved in. This is 2012, so Lisa has moved into the mother's apartment. Now Johnny's he's literally being locked out. He's, he's got family relationship, social relationship, business relationship. No history of any problems in any of that. Lisa's in town. Lisa's in charge. She shuts it all down. Lisa herself's in open conflict with Johnny in 2012. That's when McDermott will letters start showing up. That's when the lawsuit comes in. Again, out of the blue. And other witnesses at the trial, who the district court, discounted, support the, Lisa's undue influence. The neighbor, Cheryl Lockwood, who testified that...
This is a reminder, counsel, your time is ticking down.
Okay. What do I have left?
Let's say 3 minutes.
Okay. And, so Cheryl Lockwood and Maria Mesa and that set of witnesses show Lisa, the parents do want to see Johnny. They're not in conflict with him. The conflict is hers and the attorney's.
What about the fact that Mesa stopped working for John and Ann in, I think, 2012? Does that matter?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mesa
right.
Stopped working for John in 2012, I believe.
Right.
And the will was changed in
2014?
That, yes. So, yeah, so Lisa, you know, was instrumental in getting rid of this visa. And in 2014, it's Lisa's handpicked team, and she's completely isolated the father. So, but the fact that Lisa is asking to have the will change in 2012, there were a series of documents here. Late 2012 and 2013 is the father's trust goes 100% to her, and then 2014.
You say Lisa's asking, which evidence do you rely on for that?
Maria Mesa testified that before she's terminated, Lisa was bugging the father
to change the will.
Change the will, yeah. Yeah. All right, let me just turn very quickly to that, to the constitutional argument. That's the response brief treats it as not real, but this is extremely well established in the federal cases, that the whole framework that predates the 1970 Constitution, that where you have the same issue, and it's just the quirk of Illinois law that the trust goes to judge and will goes to jury. But here, the two documents are together. They're signed at the same time. It's they're identical circumstances. And the law does not allow, in a case, to say, well, the will is good, but the trust is no good. Because that brings us all into disrepute. And that's reflected in the cases. The Lytle case, and that's cited in our reply brief from the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, they point out how inconsistent decisions pose the threat of diminishing reliance on the judiciary. And Lytle actually deals with a similar thing where the jury case was thrown out, the judge rules on the bench case, and the U.S. Supreme Court says, we're saying, you know, we know what the remedy is here. The remedy is you have to vacate that bench decision and send the whole thing back for new trial. And the way it works then is that the verdict of the jury gets precedence, because in our constitutional scheme, we care about the jury more than the court, no offense, and that the court's bench decision, which is given power over the trust, has to be consistent. So this case goes back for a jury verdict on the will, and if it's no undue influence, the judge would follow that. If it's undue influence, the judge would follow that for the trust. And that's why count two needs to be vacated. And that's, in the cases we cite, it's very well established. Yes, they're federal cases, but the Illinois law that's in the Caicos v. Butler that we cite, we have a 1970 constitution that adopts the laws of 1970, and this law was well established in the federal common law at the time. And there's the other rule also in Caicos that the Illinois courts will follow the federal application of the analogous, you know, federal Seventh Amendment, unless there's a good reason not to. And there isn't any good reason not to. This is the federal circuit calls it a bedrock principle, historic principle. In the Thermatrue case, it's also in our
reply. Just as Justice Mitchell was asking you earlier, that the trust judgment has to be vacated only if the will judgment is vacated and sent back for trial.
On the constitutional grounds, yes. But we do also argue that the privilege claim on the redacted document is not privileged, and you should so rule, and that is material evidence that requires a new trial on count one and two, and a further review of in camera.
I do have one question, and that is, can you address why Lisa's actions didn't fall under the power of attorney? She had a POA as of 2011, and so I don't think the argument was made, but, you know, it begs the question as to, wasn't she authorized to take these actions pursuant to the power of attorney that she had?
Well, many of the actions she had the legal authority to do, but that's what put her in the position to have the undue influence. That's how the fiduciary rule comes into play for undue influence. Yeah. That if I'm in, and if no one's in a better position to get the will change in their favor than the person who's controlling the business and other affairs, personal, and 2014, she's controlling everything, personal, business, social. She's it for John. Right. Dad is a caretaker she hired. So.
Okay, anything else? I think
that's it. Yeah.
Thank you.
We'll hear from your friend on the other side, and then we'll hear from you again in rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Eric Brent from Brenner. I'm from Perkins Coie, and we represent the respondents, the estate of John Podmajerski Jr., and the trust created by John Podmajerski Jr. that became irrevocable upon his passing in 2014. With me is Deirdre Close from Croke Fairchild. She represents Linda Podmajerski individually. We plan to divide our time by subject. May it please the court. We propose to address the following points. First is the threshold issue of this court's jurisdiction and why respondents respectfully submit this court lacks jurisdiction. Second would be the presumption of undue influence as that doctrine has developed in the will and trust context and opposition that petitioner is mischaracterizing how this presumption operates. This relates to petitioner's argument to seek reversal of count one. Next, we propose to go through why the trial court, whether the trial court needs to defer to a non-jury case, whether the trial court needs to defer to the jury before ruling on non-jury issues, and we think petitioner has mischaracterized the applicable law there. This relates to petitioner's grounds for reversing on count two, the will contest. Then we propose to address the discovery rulings by the trial court, in particular the court's correct finding that the inadvertently produced email between me and Domingo Suk and Lisa Podmajerski acting in her capacity as trustee of Annalisa's trust was privileged and settlement communication with respect to the Churchyard case. The court is familiar, the Churchyard case is the case that John and Annalise filed in 2012 after getting nowhere in efforts to get access to their cash and control of their own business from their son, John Podmajerski III, who I refer to as JP3. And lastly, we'll address the lack of evidence for any undue influence by Lisa Podmajerski over John. The evidence at the three-week trial in this case was that John wanted to disinherit JP3 and had very good reason to do that. He was in litigation with JP3. The testimony in the record was he had a long-running dispute and animosity with his son. We heard from at trial from John's closest relative other than the immediate family, John Bunch, who testified that John, my client, felt very put out when his son took over the business and pushed him aside. We heard from an expert who looked through the medical records, and in there were testimony with John with therapists where he was complaining about feeling isolated and disrespected by his son and did not know how to respond to it. The record was replete with a long-running dispute that, it did not manifest into litigation until 2012, but to say that there was no basis is just disregarding the record. Let me first start with appellate jurisdiction because that's obviously critical to this court. And petitioner did not address the defects in appellate jurisdiction which we raised since his initial notice. We addressed this in our brief, and the reply brief did not address it at all.
Does Rule 303A2 cure the premature appeal?
303A2 would have cured premature 303 notices. But each of the notices of appeal were filed as interlocutory appeals. They asserted 304B1.
Well, they cited the wrong rule.
Absolutely.
And that's fatal?
The court held in the Nicholson case that we cite that 304B1 was defective and it's not a premature notice of appeal, it's a defective notice of appeal. So there's a material distinction. If you file an interlocutory appeal when you don't have an interlocutory right, they never sought a 304A finding. They pursued only 304B1 exclusively. After the final order in June of 2023, they did not file a 303.
But we get notices of appeal that don't even cite a Supreme Court rule. They identify the order that's being sought to be appealed. And the fact that they identified the wrong rule, they certainly put you on notice as to what order they were trying to appeal.
If 303 has any meaning, that you can't file, you don't have a right to come up to court under, when the court ruled on count two, that was the first order, they filed a 304B1. We made a motion to dismiss, or alternatively to stay, and this court granted in part that motion and stayed pending a final order. Then there's another interlocutory order, the ruling on count one. They file another 304B1. It's improper. 304B1 applies to orders entered in the administration of an estate. These are not estate administration orders. We're not paying someone out of the estate who then needs to be finalized so they can get on. These are unrelated to estate administration. These are just in probate. Not everything in probate is in estate administration. So 304B1 is clearly, I think we should be able to agree, is clearly the wrong order.
So you're saying they should have filed under 304A? Got a 304A finding and then filed under 304A?
They could have done that, but they didn't.
Or they could have filed a 304 judgment.
They could have waited. Exactly, and they didn't. So that you're facing a record where you've got defective, not premature, but just defective notices. And the question...
You might win on that if Judge Easterbrook was here.
Then I'll move on. I'd next like to address the mischaracterization of the presumption of undue influence. So the case law has developed that there's a rebuttable presumption in undue influence cases. It doesn't create a construct where if the presumption is found that a JNOV is not available. So at trial, JP3 did not even make out a prima facie case of undue influence. Had he been able to make out a prima facie case, the court indeed said, if you read his, I think, very well-reasoned written opinion, and then his the oral opinion from the bench, and then the written opinion, he assumed he had found it a prima facie case, but then found it was such overwhelming evidence that the respondents had put in as to John exercising his own free will that the presumption disappeared.
Is it in that analysis, and in your brief, you focus very heavily on the absence of contrary evidence during the 2014 time period. But the point that counsel was making is you really have to look broader than that. You have to start looking in 2011 or 2012 because his theory is, at this point, they become captive.
Well, again, they definitely weren't captive. They were going wherever they wanted. They saw whoever they wanted to see. They chose not to see JP3, because JP3 had tried to have them declared incapacitated and had himself appointed, so you have to be careful around someone like that.
But in measuring this idea of is there evidence, don't you have to consider the evidence from 2012 and 2013 and not just focus exclusively on...
I don't think the court focused exclusively on 2014, but the fact of the matter is you have to be able to prove it was operative in 2014. And if you have nothing... And the court was aware of what they had. He even talks about, you know, the Meza testimony. He just found it not probative, just like in Pedrick. There wasn't nothing on the plaintiff's side in Pedrick. There was testimony. It was a little bit inconsistent. It was a little off the mark about whether the lights were blinking or not. And the court found it just wasn't probative. That's the same thing here. Meza's testimony from 2011, and she was not fired. There was nothing in the record for that. She quit. Because she was discovered to be spying for JP3. She was making reports back to JP3, which imagine your caretaker is talking to your son that you're having this dispute with. I mean, it's such a huge... Anyhow, she quit before she was... and it was definitely not fired by Lisa. John was very much in control, and
Why don't you address the points that counsel relied on to show that there's an issue that needs to be resolved by the jury here? He pointed, for example, to the email. He pointed to a number of other things that Lisa was doing. If you could address those points.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, just like in Pedrick, there wasn't, like, no evidence, but it just was de minimis and not probative. And the court found that it wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't let a jury, had the jury decided, he would have JNOB'd it then. So, and that's why we have judges in jury trials. But here the jury didn't reach a verdict. The only evidence of any actions in 2014 that they appear to rely on in their brief is this email. And the email is very much misconstrued from what you just heard. It is not about John's estate plan. The email is titled proposal, because I was talking with Lisa as we were trying to come up, Lisa Pomerjerski, as we were trying to come up with a settlement proposal for the Churchyard case, and she is a plaintiff in the Churchyard case because she is the trustee of Ann's trust. So I had spoken with John Pomerjerski days before. I speak with Lisa to, again, try to develop a proposal. Lisa writes me back. So the first email is Lisa responding to my conversation about what could we offer in settlement, how do we want to structure this. She includes Domingo Soup because he was involved in the relationship with his with her parents. And he responds back that you need to understand what Ann's estate, and indeed that's even from the unredacted parts, Ann's estate did a few things. That's Mr. Soup's email. He's discussing Ann's estate with the trustee of Ann's trust so that she knows what the parameters of the trust of which she operates. It's in the context of settlement, which would, of course, make it inadmissible, even if it was not privileged. But that email is part of a three-email chain where the first one is clearly the settlement proposal. Mr. Soup then instructs the trustee, as trust counsel should do, as to what the parameters of the trust are. And then the email, the latest in the chain, is mine with actual draft email to James Carey, who had just taken over from Arnstein and Lehrer as JP3's counsel. And I knew people at that firm, and Mr. Soup knew Mr. Carey, and we thought it was a good opportunity to try to make this proposal. And it's not talking about John's estate plan. And the comment by Mr. Soup at the end that it's time, you know, that aspect of Lisa, what she did is logistics for John, time's coming that her father updated his estate plan. The reason Mr. Soup writes that is he knew well what John wanted to do because he had spoken with John many times in 2014. That's in the record about his estate plan without Lisa present. He had been in the connection with the 2013 estate plan. He had met with John and Annalise about this exact issue. What do you want to do with your estate plan?
This is Mr. Soup's testimony you're referring to?
Yes. And Ms. Park also corroborated it. They both met. Ms. Park and Mr. Soup met with John and Annalise at length in 2013 when they signed their 2013 estate plan. Mr. Soup testified that he met with John, I think it's in February of 2014. We obviously have many discussions with John about the litigation, and as happens in a lot of, you know, law firms, the estate bills and we did not produce the litigation lawyer invoices, and, you know, there was extensive contacts between John and lawyers then at Perkins and Coie about the litigation.
So let me turn to the emails. I don't know if you have I see you have a redacted document there, and I don't know if that's an unredacted version, but what did the judge review?
You know, I am clear that he definitely had the unredacted, because we attached that to the brief. And I know the record is not very clear. I believe
you're clear that you're saying the judge reviewed the unredacted version?
That's my recollection. I say the record it's not shown as attached to the brief. I know we had it with us, and I can't remember if he, my recollection is, you know, for whatever, as an officer of the court, was he took it back and went in chambers. And that was the in-camera review. It's not attached to our brief, but I don't.
Well, the redacted email presumably would not, I mean, the unredacted email probably would not be attached to any publicly filed document, right?
The redacted email was attached to a copy provided in chambers under seal. But we had a public copy and a non-public copy.
So my question is, why would a judge waste her time reading a redacted email?
Agreed, but even the redacted email makes it very plain, especially in when you put it into context, what's going on in May of 2014.
Well, maybe, well I don't know. How clear, I mean, if you don't have the entire document in front of you, then how do you know what's been concealed?
I agree. I think my recollection is he had the unredacted document. But even if he has only the redacted document, it is clear what is going on from the title of the document, from the timing. I mean, this one is the entirely redacted one is, here is a draft email of a settlement. And the other unredacted email begins, proposal. Hi, Eric, as a follow-up to our conversation yesterday. We're talking, and it goes through how to pitch what concepts to use in settlement. This is a settlement. Lawyers and a client, Lisa as trustee of the AM Trust, strategizing on ways to settle a case. And, and that was what this email was about. It should never have been produced in redacted or unredacted form, and it had no, and even if it had been produced, it would not be admissible under 408A because it's a settlement communication, very plainly. And it's not subject to the testamentary exception because it doesn't relate, it's talking about the Ann estate to the Ann trustee. It's not, it's not even planning, estate planning, it is settlement planning.
How many other issues do you have left?
I'm going to be stepping on this close. Let me briefly address count two. It was undisputed count two, which is the will contest, the trust contest, was for the court to decide. The jury was advisory only, and advisory juries are just that. You could take their advice or not. The petitioner does not point in their briefs to any error by the court in a well-reasoned opinion he read from the bench, very detailed. Judge Murphy was a very conscientious judge on this trial. The only attack on count two appears to be petitioner's contention that it was premature because count two has to be consistent with count one. There's just no basis in law to argue that a court cannot decide count two until count one was resolved. No basis. This is an abuse of discretion standard. The judge can decide which counts to decide first, how to run, and by deciding count two, where he felt there was very overwhelming evidence, before count one, is totally within his prerogative. It was that overwhelming evidence that then led him, as we were preparing for a retrial on count one, to come to the conclusion that he could not, no matter what the jury did, allow a verdict in favor of the petitioner to stand. And that was why I think he did a remarkable and thoughtful thing, and he admitted his own error and fixed it. I guess I'm not sure what time we have left for this close.
We have some time left.
I will turn it over to
Well, we went over in appellant's argument, so you have until 4 minutes after.
If no further questions, I'll thank you.
Good Good morning, Justices. My name is Deirdre Close. I am from the law firm Croke, Fairchild, Duarte & Barris, and I represent Lisa Podmajerski individually. May it please the Court, we reaffirm the arguments that Eric Branfenbrenner has presented. And as you're aware, in the trial court, Lisa Podmajerski defended against the claims that she unduly influenced her father in connection with his estate and trust documents. As you know, the trial court found that the evidence at trial overwhelmingly established that Lisa's father, John Podmajerski Jr.'s will and trust were the product of his desires, and the terms were freely chosen by him. Further, the trial court found that the evidence failed to establish that Lisa Podmajerski exerted undue influence over her father in connection with his 2014 will and trust. In short, the record is replete with evidence that John was a capable, strong-willed, and decisive man who made his own choices. It is also replete with evidence that he was angry and disappointed with his son and his son's refusal to return control over the assets which John and his wife worked their life to amass. And the testimony from the attorneys that John willingly, knowingly, and purposefully directed his lawyers to draft estate plans that would effectively disinherit his son was unrebutted. In contrast, the record lacks evidence of any undue influence by Lisa Podmajerski over John Podmajerski Jr. Undue influence is influence exerted upon the decedent which causes him to make a disposition of his property that is not a free and voluntary act. So if we turn to, I do recognize you've read the record, you've read the briefs, but in the reply brief, and as counsel stood up here today to reference all of the evidence of Lisa's undue influence in the record, there's a lot that doesn't exist that has been referenced here. I think there's an important distinction between what is a theory based on a story versus what is evidence. If you turn to the record, Jared Clout, we have multiple attorneys who testified they represented John. They followed John's directives and John's wishes. We have the testimony of Jared Clout, who is John's lawyer, when John and his wife had to resort to filing a lawsuit against Johnny to recover control of their businesses and their cash. He testified regarding the tumultuous relationship between John and his son as John struggled to regain control of his assets. Domingo Suk, the attorney who worked with John to draft his estate plans, he testified that he communicated directly with John regarding his own specific wishes and that John was in control of his estate plans. Suk testified that he had no doubt that the 2014 will and trust documents reflected John's wishes. Suk testified that Lisa never asked him to draft the documents and that he did not take direction from her. We have Lucy Park, an attorney who was also involved in the discussion and execution of John's estate plans. She testified that she personally discussed with John the details and impacts of his estate plans as related to the issue of what his son would or would not inherit, and that John understood with conviction the choices that he was making. Ms. Park testified that Lisa was not present for these discussions or for the signing of the documents. She also testified regarding the instructions given by John, which were incorporated into the letter of wishes, which was drafted by Ms. Park. The letter further memorialized John's wishes to disinherit his son, as well as his concern that his son would attempt to challenge the estate plans after his death. We also have testimony from the guardian ad litem that was appointed by the court to meet with John to assess John's capacity to control his finances when his son attempted to have him declared incompetent. Mr. Epstein noted John to have deeply held and personal convictions regarding his son, to have an understanding of his financial affairs, noting that he did not trust his son and that he was angry with his son.
Johnny's theory is largely based on circumstantial evidence, which often these cases are. And does it matter that the jury, I think the jury deadlocked in this case? Is that significant?
Respectfully, we moved for a directed verdict because we did not think that the case should have gone to the jury.
And the judge disagreed?
The judge disagreed. However, in reconsideration, it was 11-1 and the jury deadlocked. However, when the judge reviewed the record, when he was entering his judgment on count two, he was looking at all of the witness testimony. And even that testimony that existed regarding Lisa wasn't testimony that she was involved in the procurement of the will. It wasn't testimony regarding her.
So, for example, what about Mesa, M-E-Z-A? Granted, she left in 2012, but what about that evidence?
So, Maria Mesa was a longtime friend and employee of Johnny. The court found her not just to be a not credible witness, referred to her as a liar. Her testimony was, in the court's assessment, absolutely not believable. But even so, the court said, if we take her testimony that she said, and she quoted, that she heard Lisa saying Johnny was a steel guy, and then the other testimony was that she was bugging her father to change his will. Okay? If those two things are true, it still does not get you over the threshold of undue influence. And as our...
Why?
Well, more importantly, does it get you over Pedrick? I mean, isn't that enough?
In 2011, for a statement to be made that precedes the point in time in which John's parents sue John to regain control of their business, they engage in multiple meetings with their counsel about changing estate plans. They are consistently involved in litigation. And then the mother passes away. The son brings a counterclaim. 2 days after his mother passes away, serves a counterclaim, an 80-page counterclaim, claiming both of his parents are engaging in fraud, serves that on the father right after the mother dies. Father subsequently changes the will. I don't see how Maria Meza's comments, which so far preceded all of those circumstances, is probative. And the judge found so as well. I mean, ultimately, the judge being able to preside over the trial and assess the credibility of the witnesses, when it is so overwhelmingly not in the favor of the movement or the non-movement, you would never have a situation where you could have a directed verdict if the judge can't make those credibility determinations. This isn't an issue of the judge making credibility determinations on all of the witnesses and saying, okay.
So if it was a bench trial, I mean, I would tend to agree with you, but if it's a jury trial, you're talking about credibility of witnesses, how much can a judge do that under the Pedrick standard?
If the judge found that there is absolutely no basis for credibility in the witness, and that the witness's testimony is not probative. I mean, if you look to the Pedrick standard, there's testimony regarding the flashing lights as they're approaching the railroad tracks. And there's some witnesses that say, I think there were flashing lights. And there's some that say, I don't recall if there were flashing lights. There's inconsistencies. And under the Pedrick standard, they were saying that the rule was that if there's no circumstance under which the case could be upheld on the evidence that's presented, then if there's no contrary verdict could stand, then you can enter a directed verdict. Now, even if, you know, our expert on undue influence, Dr. Shima, she was explaining that in the field of undue influence, if a child says, hey, mom, I want you to give me the house. I'd really like you to give me the house. That's not undue influence. That's not somebody wanting something. So even if Lisa had said, which we contest, but even if she had said, Dad, I want you to change the will, how is that undue influence? How does that cross the threshold to be undue influence? And then, again, you know, this far preceded, this alleged statement, far preceded all of the acts which led up to the ultimate disinheritance in 2014.
I think you're down to your final minute.
Okay. Again, just to comment on some of the comments made by petitioner's counsel, Lisa's interference or purported interference with the attorney-client relationship of Begain is a theory. There is no evidence to support that. It is simply a theory. John did not proceed with attorney Begain. He proceeded with Domingo Souk. He retained Domingo Souk. In terms of the testimony that the parents didn't want Mr. Souk, there's no evidence of that. In terms of the testimony that Lisa shut down the Begain relationship, no evidence of that. In terms of the parents cracking under pressure to retain Domingo Souk, there is no evidence of that. And the blatant statement that there was no history of problems between John and his son Johnny is defied by extreme amounts of evidence within this record. Respectfully, we would request that the court affirm the rulings below on counts 1 and 2, and in light of the rulings on counts 1 and 2, the court should also affirm the dismissal of count 3 on the basis of lack of standing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So on the directed verdict, and their argument, which was, you know, mirrors what the trial court found, it credits Lisa's own counsel, the Perkins Coie's attorneys, and the McDermott Will, Mr. Cloud, he also testified, their testimony. All right, this isn't direct coming from John. Yes, there's a July 29, 2014 letter that John signed. It's legalese. Ms. Park, the attorney, drafted it. And, I mean, what happened here in granting the directed verdict is, you know, their argument, well, it's not probative enough. But what they're really arguing is that weighing the evidence is okay, you know, the case isn't good enough. We're on Pedrick. We're on directed verdict. It's judgment as a matter of law where there's no evidence to sustain a verdict, and that does not allow weighing of evidence. You know, what we contend here in rebutting the attorney testimony, and it's attorney testimony about litigation, and there's lots of evidence that John didn't have any clear idea what was going on in this litigation. In the trial courts,
What is that evidence that John didn't understand what was going on in the churchyard litigation?
Right. Well, Ms. Park takes a stand and says, well, John said, why would I give anything to my son who's suing me? Right. Well, in his name, the suit was filed by him against his son. And we went over some of this in the principal argument of, you know, the guardian and the, and John is not involved in litigation. Lisa is involved in litigation. The lawyers are dealing with Lisa, not John. And in the trial court, credits Mr. Soup, Ms. Park, and he credits the documents.
Well, Lisa's involved in the churchyard litigation in her capacity as trustee, right? Of Ann's trust?
She's had multiple hats, and I'm not sure what they say. I mean, she's trustee. She's got general partnership role. She's special assistant in things. I mean, what the reality is that Lisa is in charge. She's the one dealing with the attorneys, not John. John is in the dark. That's our contention.
The attorneys testify that Lisa was not involved in any discussion points about changing the will or estate. I mean, that's unrebutted, right?
No. I mean, they say that it's that her involvement was ministerial in the estate planning. Early on, there's emails where she prefaces it, and the court relied on some of this, that, well, my parents want this, my parents want that. And he credits that as being the true intent of the parents when it's only coming from Lisa. It's not corroborated by anything from the parents. Those attorneys, the Perkins Coie's attorneys, testify. They represent, the firm represents Lisa in this case, in this role. They're her attorneys. And Lisa was instrumental. She's the one that got Mr. Souk involved, first at McDermott, now at Perkins, in what's been a very lucrative relationship. They have interest. There's no matter of law that those lawyers must be believed by a jury. And there's more. You know, Mr. Souk, on the stand, he testified about calls and meetings that he had with the parents. But there's impeachment. This is in our brief, pointing to the record. There's one example. There's the claim that it was February 2013, there was a meeting, and that's where John wants to disinherit Johnny. And then there's a July set of documents that relate to that. And then, you know, again, of course, July 2014. And Mr. Souk, he had a practice that he took notes of these important meetings, but there's no notes of this one. And then when we go to 2014, there's testimony from Ms. Park and Mr. Souk about communicating with John up to the July 2014 will. But the bills don't reflect any of that. There's no documentation of anything. Ms. Park shows up July 29 with that letter that gets signed. And I think her testimony was, oh, this was some back and forth with John. Well, John couldn't hear. You can't call him on the phone and talk about a letter about trusts and things, because that sort of stuff didn't happen. And the real key for the trial court...
You're saying John was hard of hearing?
Yes, that's well documented in the papers here.
Well, counsel, indicate what other evidence was there of his lack of capacity to, you know, be involved in, you know, these legal matters and to oversee what Lisa was doing.
Well, we set the record in a brief about the history of his involvement in his business. He did the properties, you know, the rehab and things like that. It was Annalise, the mother, who dies in 2013, who handled all the business stuff, including dealing with Johnny over Johnny's management of the properties, which was, again, there's nothing in the record that they had any dispute with Johnny about his management.
I'm referring to John's lack of capacity.
Well, so John had never been involved in the business aspect.
But it doesn't mean he's not capable.
Well, yeah, right. This is not a lack of capacity case. It's an undue influence case.
Yeah.
Right? And Lisa, our contention is that Lisa turned John against John. And that, you know, Maria Mesa's testimony in 2011, Johnny is a steel guy. The trial court didn't like that because she has bad English. He says, oh, there's no way that Lisa would say Johnny was a steel guy. Well, of course, Lisa speaks probably perfect English and Ms. Mesa didn't. But he just totally discarded it. It can't be discarded as a matter of law.
Well, with that, I think we're down to our final seconds.
Okay. And I will mention the email one more time. We had, so it wasn't attached to any motion in 2020. The brief cites the record of how this was dealt with. This was added to the record by motion that we filed during the appeal phase. And this is the document that he reviewed. Right? He was asked to look behind the redactions, and he refused to do it. You know, he said there's no rational reason to do it. He wouldn't do it. And so at the time...
That would seem to undermine the entire purpose of an in-camera review. Why would a judge review what you folks already have?
Well, they wanted to claw it back. They wanted us to not have it. So we had to give it... He ruled that we had to give it...
So both sites had it. So why does a judge need to review it? I mean,
well,
you both have a document that's at issue. Right. You can make your argument. Why am I... I mean, you know, as a trial judge, when you're faced with the task of doing an in-camera review, it's such a burden. Anyone who's done it will understand. And I'm just struggling to understand why a judge would waste his time reviewing a redacted document to determine whether a claim of privilege is valid or not.
Because there was an immediate issue of this document that had been produced and they wanted to claw back, yeah. And there's rules providing for that. And
because it's the unredacted portion, which is the part that is subject to the privilege fund.
Correct. That's it. That's it. And so that's why he only looked at this
unredacted portion that's the subject of privilege.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it was everything that's redacted is not, there's no issue about privilege there.
Or that settlement stuff, right?
Yeah, well, we asked to have the trial court on remand be directed to do more review. Mr. Soup, the estate planner, his name is all over these supposed litigation documents, including this one. It's not litigation, at least part of it. And that requires review. So we do want the in-camera review to go beyond. But this specific exhibit, this one that I gave the, you know, sub E3621 is the top page of the email. This is the document that the trial court reviewed because the unredacted part was the claim of privilege being decided. He sustained it. We say it was error. Okay. And we also want the trial court to go beyond.
So your opponent says that it was a completely unredacted document that he believes the court reviewed. And you're saying that's not the case. It was that document that's in your hand and that the part that's redacted we need not concern ourselves with because what was at issue was the unredacted portion of the document.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we moved in the trial court and they didn't say, no, it's some other document that was at issue. It's this document.
Okay.
So, thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel, and counsel for both sides. I want to commend you on excellent arguments here today, and the briefing was outstanding, and that will be taken under advisement for ruling. Your respective clients should, no matter how the appeal is decided, they should know that they've been very capably represented. We thank you for retaining such very fine lawyers.
We're adjourned.